He holds the knife in his hand as he stands over her. The blood blooms across her pajamas, and in that moment, he has a choice. Soon he's in the car, the apartment that now houses her body, disappearing in the rearview mirror. His breath has slowed, and his heart rate is back to normal. A plan is falling into place. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 192, The Murder of Rachel Tshabalala. Make upgrading your home security a priority with Ring's range of smart security devices, indoor and outdoor cameras, video doorbells and alarms. Ring products are easy to install and allow you to monitor your home from your phone or tablet via the Ring app, no matter where you are. With cameras in strategic locations, indoors and outdoors, you can create a ring of security around your property. Ring security devices boast advanced features, including live view, two-way talk, motion-activated alerts, and night vision. Available at Takealot, Incredible Connection, Hersh's, and other major retailers. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You? Yes, you. Are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at True Crime South Africa. /donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Madeleine DeVet, Hannery Mayer, Karen Egan, Christo Sneyman, Elaine, Dina Mayer, and Arena Griesel for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive content including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Keba. Today's case was actually quite well publicized at the time it happened, because of the low-level celebrity of the perpetrator. I wanted to highlight it, though, for a few reasons. One is that it's likely the perpetrator will become eligible for parole soon, and I think the victim deserves for her story to be told, so that when he does, we remember exactly what happened. Another reason is that this case is a perfect example of how we should never accept what we see as the public image of a person to be the absolute truth of who they are behind closed doors. I think we tend to let our guard down around people, men in this particular case, who present themselves in the public domain as allies and advocates for safe spaces for women. And regardless of gender, you never quite know what's really behind that front. Another example of that is the recent guilty finding in the case of a preschool teacher, Amber Hughes, who you would think would be a safe space for children, right? Well, no. Turns out not so much. Because She's been found guilty of the rape and murder of her boyfriend's young daughter, Nada Jane Chilita. She's an attractive, kind-looking woman who I've no doubt hundreds of parents trusted their children with over the years because of the image she portrayed. And this is the truth of the real character she was hiding all that time. In researching today's case, I used the sentencing documents, several media articles, and an article from the Sivamis magazine. So, let's get into episode 192, The Murder of Rachel Shabalala.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Rachel Shabalala was born on the 17th of March 1982 to her mother, Elizabeth. Her full birth name was Flavia Rachel Dolly Shabalala, and she actually mostly went by Dolly, so that's how I'll refer to her here. Dolly was always the kind of young woman who had her life on track. She did well at school, and her mom said that she was a joy to raise. She married relatively young and had a daughter with her husband in 2007. Dolly was committed to her academic journey too, and graduated with her first degree, and then went on to start a second degree in psychology almost right away. After initially graduating, Dolly worked at Wits University in the environmental engineering faculty. While her career and education pursuits were going well, Dolly's marriage was struggling. And finally, in 2012, she and her husband officially separated with a view to divorcing. While out with friends one night, Dolly met Donald Sebolai, and the pair quickly hit it off. Donald was a bit of a low-level celebrity in certain circles. He worked as a radio DJ on Josie FM and hosted their 9 a.m. to midday slot, including a segment called the Women's Lifestyle Show. The show focused predominantly on issues from a woman's perspective, ranging from parenting to relationships and career. A big focus on the show was gender-based violence and abuse within intimate relationships. And Donald and his co-hosts would often discuss the scourge of GBV and how women could escape cycles of violence. His role on radio as this sort of ally to women and an activist against GBV had made him very popular among the station's female listeners, and they'd given him the cute nickname Donald Duck. Donald really was quite an expert on relationships because, well, he'd had quite a lot of them. By the time he met Dolly in 2013, Donald had had three relatively serious relationships, which had each produced one child. He'd only just broken up with his most recent girlfriend, with whom he had a son, when he and Dolly crossed paths. The couple's relationship moved quickly, and Dolly's mother would later say that she hadn't really liked Donald from the beginning. She'd wanted her daughter to finalise her divorce and have some time to work through the emotions of that before getting into a new relationship. But Donald was charming and seemed to sweep Dolly off her feet. Donald lived in an apartment in Jabulani in Soweto, and Dolly would eventually start living there part-time too. She had her own vehicle, and Donald often made use of it, so the arrangement was beneficial to him too. Although Donald paid some form of financial maintenance for his three children, it doesn't appear that he split custody with his previous partners, and the children rarely visited him at home. When they occasionally did during the school holidays, Dolly couldn't stay over because there wasn't enough space for everyone. She really didn't seem to mind this, though, and after all, she had her own daughter, who by that time was 7 years old, to focus on. Dolly's childhood friend, Nontlantla Mkize, would later say that Dolly and Donald's relationship had never really been healthy, in her opinion. She'd become aware of quite a bit of violence from Donald to Dolly, as well as emotional and verbal abuse. After leaving her own marriage, Dolly was not particularly confident. And because Donald had a fan base and really had zero boundaries around his female listeners and fans, she often felt that this behavior bordered on cheating. Donald did not see things the same way, though, and their disagreements about his flirtations often escalated into shouting matches and Donald physically lashing out at Dolly. It would later emerge that this was not his only relationship that had followed this pattern, and previous partners would also admit that they'd been on the receiving end of physical abuse from Donald too. For his part, Donald would only ever admit to what he called slapping his partners. And while the rest of us might believe that that's bad enough, Donald would claim that he believed there was nothing wrong with that. He'd only ever done so, he claimed, when he needed to, quote, get his partner back in line, end quote. We'll discuss this more later. But of course, I don't have to tell you that this is physical abuse. And the idea that one partner has the right to raise their hand to another in any context is ludicrous, let alone the very strange idea that either partner should be made to shrink themselves behind a line the other created. These instances of abuse did lead to several reports to the police from Dolly, but as is often the case, she would end up either dropping the charges, or when police suggested she take out a protection order against Donald, she was concerned about his public image, and as a result, that his job might be affected. So she never did. Donald had also approached police for assistance in his relationship, but it wasn't because of any abuse from Dolly. Rather, and brace yourself for this one, in March 2014, Donald had gone to Jabulani Police Station and asked a police officer to accompany him to his flat and help him to remove Dolly from the premises. The officer in question knew Donald and Dolly because they dealt with a few of Dolly's complaints in the past. This was the first time that Donald had approached the SAPS, though. And his reasoning was simply wild. He told the officer that he wanted Dolly out of his flat because their sex life was not enjoyable to him. I'm not even going to use the words he used to describe Dolly's genitalia to this police officer, because honestly, it's just incredibly disrespectful to her. But Donald was essentially telling the officer that Dolly was unable to satisfy his needs in the bedroom, and so he wanted her to leave, and he claimed she was refusing. At the flat, the officer found a distraught Dolly, who was actually already packing her bags to leave. She was clearly mortified that Donald had gone to repeat these insults to a police officer, and the officer said Dolly left of her own accord shortly after he arrived. The same police officer had been at the apartment on two occasions in February that year. On both occasions, Dolly had reported to him that Donald had threatened to assault and kill her. At this point, it appears that Dolly and Donald did break up, at least for the time being. But Dolly's mother would later say that during the period between March and June, when Dolly was staying with her, Donald would often arrive at the house, banging on the door and demanding that Dolly come out and speak to him. By June 2014, Donald and Dolly were seeing each other again. On the evening of the 28th of June, Dolly was at a local tavern, and Donald joined her there, followed a little later by Donald's sister. All three had continued drinking until around midnight, when they'd left in Dolly's car. They'd dropped Donald's sister off at her home, and then went back to Donald's flat. In the early hours of the morning of the 29th of June, Donald's sister received a WhatsApp message from her brother. In the text, Donald told her that he had injured Dolly the previous night, but he assured her that they were both fine. Shortly after this message, one of Dolly's friends tried to call her. Donald answered the cell phone and initially told her that Dolly was eating and she would phone her back. He hung up, but the woman phoned back almost immediately. He then told the woman that Dolly was dead. Her friend thought Donald was making some sort of sick joke, and she told him to stop talking nonsense and put Dolly on the line. Donald repeated that she was dead, and then hung up the phone. Not long after this, Dolly's estranged husband, Temba, received a call from Donald. He was told that Dolly had been killed and that she could be found in his flat. A stunned Temba had no time to ask any clarifying questions as the call disconnected in his ear. Over the next few minutes, Temba made phone calls to several of Dolly's friends and family members to figure out whether she was with them. He spoke with a friend who'd connected with Donald earlier that morning, and she said that she'd honestly thought Donald was making a horrible joke. But with Temba having received the call he had, there certainly seemed to be cause for concern, and Temba drove straight to the Jabulani police station. An officer accompanied him to the flat. It was locked up and Dolly's car was gone. Some time was spent phoning Dolly's phone, which appeared to be switched off, as well as a few other people to ensure that no one had seen her. But eventually the officer agreed, considering the history of violence and disputes at the apartment, that they would break down the door to check on Dolly. Inside the flat, the first sign of the horror that had occurred there was a bloodied mop behind the door. As the officer moved through the kitchen and lounge area, he noticed a few drops of what appeared to be blood on the carpets and tiles. He called out for Dolly, but there was no response. Finally, in the main bedroom, the truth of Donald's words were laid bare. Dolly Shabalala lay on her back on the bed. She had clearly been dead for a few hours. Other than a few blood spots around the flat, the scene appeared to have been well cleaned, and the lack of blood, especially on Dolly's body, at first glance, was rather perplexing. It would only be once an officer spotted a blob of blood underneath Dolly's body that one of the officers carefully pulled down her pajama pants to reveal her cause of death. Dolly had sustained a severe sharp force injury, which had started in her groin area and stretched down her thigh. The wound was 1 centimeter wide and 3 centimeters long. An autopsy would later reveal that the wound extended to a depth of at least 9 centimeters. Initially, there would be conflicting reports about how many stab wounds Dolly had sustained. Many reports said 3, and even initial investigative reports said that. But the pathologist would later testify in court that once he had opened up her body for autopsy, the truth was revealed, and it appeared to be 1 stab wound with dragging of the knife through the skin. The knife appeared to have entered at just the wrong angle and punctured an artery in Dolly's thigh, causing massive bleeding. But there was no immediate evidence of this massive bleeding on the scene. Her pajama pants, which should have been drenched in blood, were almost pristine, and the bed underneath her had just a few drops of blood on it. A full search of the flat revealed a very bloody rug and a man's shirt with blood on it inside the washing machine, which had not been switched on. In a dustbin outside the flat, a bloodied pair of man's pants were found, discarded. Immediately, officers put out an alert for Dolly's car, and the man they figured had to be driving it, and who was the most likely suspect, Donald Sebolin. In the hours that followed, as the message began to spread among Dolly's friends and family that she'd been murdered, horror and grief turned to anger. It was immediately apparent that Donald was a major suspect in Dolly's murder, and yet he was nowhere to be found. As the news of the murder made its way to Donald's employer, Josie FM, the station manager sent him a message, asking him to come to the station to talk about what was happening. He received a text back from Donald saying, quote, "I don't want to spoil your brand. I did some shit. My girlfriend is dead." End quote. For 9 days, Donald Sebalai remained on the run. A 50,000 rand reward was issued, and the police put out calls through the media for the man to hand himself over. Donald's mother, to whom he appears very close, also spoke to journalists and asked them to publish her own appeal for her son to hand himself over to authorities. She deeply feared that he would be injured or even killed if they found him first and he tried to flee. A few days after Dolly's murder, her car was found abandoned in a field. The mystery of where all the blood from her wound had gone was solved when in the back seat, police found a bloodied pair of women's pajama pants, a dressing gown, and several towels also soaked in blood. A bloodied steak knife was also found in the car, as well as quite a lot of men's clothing, which appeared clean and freshly ironed, and was folded neatly. Josie FM listeners were horrified that the man whose voice had filled their mornings and who had seemingly so strongly advocated in women's spaces, was now the main suspect in the murder of his own girlfriend. Several tips came in over the days that Donald was on the run. All led to nothing, until one tip, on the 8th of July, led police to a petrol station. A neighbour of one of Donald's family members had witnessed the man exiting his relative's house that morning and getting into a vehicle with his relative. The vehicle registration number was put out, and a police unit quickly spotted the vehicle pulling up to a pump. Donald Sebalai was arrested without incident. Inside the relative's vehicle, police found a suitcase packed with clothing and other essentials. The relative admitted that Donald had said he was intending on crossing the border into Botswana. Donald would deny this and claimed instead that he'd been on the way to the police station to hand himself over and he'd packed a bag because he knew he'd need clothing for his court appearances. He claimed that he'd been walking the streets of Soweto for the past 9 days and had not eaten until the day of his arrest. He said he'd been trying to process what had happened and decide whether he was going to end his life. He'd eventually decided, he claimed, to hand himself over. News of Donald's arrest was welcomed by Dolly's loved ones. For almost 10 days, they'd had no idea where the man was, what his plans were, or whether he'd ever be caught and face justice. Now, their grief entered a new phase, and they had to start facing the man in court. 4 days after Donald's arrest, Rachel Dolly Shabalala was laid to rest. It seemed fitting that her final farewell would be after Donald had been captured and sat in a jail cell awaiting proceedings. Donald Sebalai was charged with murder, theft for having taken Dolly's car, and defeating the ends of justice for having cleaned up the crime scene. On the 16th of July, he entered a plea of not guilty on all charges. In his plea statement, he claimed that he and Dolly had argued that night, after he told her that his son would be coming to stay with them for part of the school holidays and that she would have to move out. He claimed that Dolly had become enraged, grabbed a knife from the kitchen, and attempted to stab him. He said that she'd been stabbed during the struggle for the knife and he had not intended for her to be injured or to die. In his plea statement, he admitted to changing her pajama pants and claimed that he'd done so in preparation to take her to the hospital for treatment. When he was asked whether Dolly was alive while he was changing her clothing on the bed, Donald refused to answer. He was declined bail at this time, because he'd remained on the run for so long and there were indications that he'd intended to flee the country, so releasing him would be too risky. After having spent Christmas and New Year's in prison, Donald reapplied for bail in January 2015 and was granted bail of 10,000 rand. It would take a full year for Donald to come to trial, and when proceedings began in July 2015, he once again confirmed that he would be pleading not guilty and maintained that he had not intentionally stabbed Dolly, and in fact she may well have accidentally stabbed herself when they were wrestling for the knife. The state presented more than 10 witnesses in its initial argument. These included several police officers, both those who could attest to what they'd seen at the crime scene and in Dolly's abandoned car, as well as those who had dealt with the couple prior to Dolly's murder. Some of Dolly's friends testified about their knowledge of Donald's abusive behaviour toward Dolly, and her mother testified about her own negative interactions with the man. Although in cases like this, the defence case is usually quite brief, and the accused will often leave it up to the state to prove they did it, rather than prove they didn't, Donald's defence case was actually quite packed with information and testimony. Equally unusual was that he decided to take the stand himself. Prosecutors often rub their hands in anticipation when this happens, as an accused who's created a fabricated version will often get themselves tangled up in lies on the stand, and cross-examination can lead to telling revelations. When Donald Sebolai took the stand, his lawyer began by asking him about his relationship with Dolly. The man claimed that he'd fallen in love with Dolly the first time he saw her, and he'd considered their problems as being quite normal for any relationship. On that first day of his testimony, there wasn't very much time available before adjournment for the day, and the trial resumed 2 days later, with Donald back on the stand. It seemed that he may have decided to shift his narrative of Dolly slightly during that time, because now he wasn't painting their relationship as normal, but rather he began to lash out at Dolly's character. Donald insisted that Dolly had had a drinking problem, and that she'd assaulted him physically and abused him verbally on several occasions when she was drunk. He claimed that Dolly was very jealous and would create a fight out of what he perceived as innocent interactions with other women. Donald painted himself as a patient and protective boyfriend who had always kept an eye out for Dolly, who, despite being an adult and a mother, he portrayed as almost a child who could not be trusted with her own safety. One story he told, which she obviously thought would show how protective and loving he was, really gave a rather dark view into Donald's true nature. He recounted a night when he and Dolly had been out drinking with one of his friends, Sizwe. He said that at one stage, both Dolly and Sizwe had become very drunk and had been unfit to remain inside the venue they were at. As an aside, this was another pervasive theme with Donald, where he would regularly portray himself as the only adult in the room, and the one who had to ensure everyone else was safe and taken care of. In this instance, he said that he'd guided his friend and Dolly outside to her car, where he told Sizwe to sit in the passenger seat and have a nap, and he'd let Dolly lay down in the back seat. Rather than taking them all home, Donald allegedly left Dolly and Sizwe in the parked car to sleep and went back inside to continue the party on his own. He claimed that about half an hour later, he'd gone outside to check on them and noticed that Sizwe was no longer in the front seat. When he approached the car, he says he found both Sizwe and Dolly in the back seat, and noticed that Dolly's pants were unbuttoned and slightly pulled down. Dolly herself was still passed out, he claimed. He recognized, as he put it, quote, that Sizwe had probably been trying to take advantage of Dolly, end quote. And so, of course, he took his friend on for possibly sexually assaulting his girlfriend, right? Well, no. Instead, Donald quite proudly told the court that he'd told Sizwe to go back inside and he'd pulled Dolly out of the car, screamed at her until she woke up, and then reprimanded her for a long time for, quote, putting herself in a position where something like this could happen, end quote. He then put her back in the car and gone back to drinking with his friend, who he allegedly believed had just attempted or completed a sexual assault on his girlfriend. So, in Donald's mind, it was Dolly's fault for being drunk, and his friend's actions were a completely understandable result of her behavior. As Donald told the courts this, he didn't seem to understand the reaction of those in the gallery, who gasped and looked horrified at what he was recounting. To him, this seemed to underpin how out of control Dolly was, and how he had always had her best interests in mind. Right. This story would eventually lead Donald's testimony down a very odd, and as far as I'm concerned, pointless path. If there were any point to it, I think it was only to attempt to sully Dolly's character, and possibly also to paint Donald as some sort of sexual dynamo. Despite what the police officer had testified to around Donald telling them that he was unhappy with his sex life with Dolly and had certain issues with her genitalia, Donald claimed that he would never have said this about his girlfriend, and as far as he was concerned, they had an excellent sex life, which included having sex at least 5 times per week. In addition, Donald went on to claim that he and Dolly had a threesome on several occasions with one of her friends, and this had only stopped happening when Dolly had become jealous that he was enjoying sex with her friend more than sex with her. I'm not going to name this friend, although he did, because in later testimony this woman would deny that this had ever happened. Donald had also claimed that during one of these encounters, when Dolly had become jealous, she'd attacked him and slapped and punched him, and he had not retaliated. He claimed that this was witnessed by her friend. The young woman denied ever witnessing this either. I think one of the oddest things about Donald's testimony is that each time he was presented with the testimony about him having insulted Donnie's genitals and having been unhappy with them, he would bring up his mother. So, as his defense to claims that he'd said Dolly's genitals were unsatisfactory to him, he'd said that he would never say such a thing because, after all, his mother was a woman, and he'd come out of a woman's genitals. This happened a few times during his testimony, and honestly, I find it really odd that this would be the specific association he would make. But maybe that's just me. Donald claimed that all of Dolly's attempts to get help from the police around his abuse of her were simply her way of trying to ruin his reputation, and their disagreements had been nothing but normal couple squabbles, which she had blown out of proportion. This line of questioning and the eventual cross-examination thereof would finally lead to that statement I referenced earlier, in which Donald admitted to having slapped both Dolly and some of his previous partners and stated in court on the record that there was nothing wrong with him doing so, and he did not consider slapping his partner to be assault. The prosecutor was certainly not going to leave this unexplored and pressed Donald deeply about his thought process around this. She asked if he could actually fathom what he was saying, and Donald seemed completely clueless that she had any point. He continued to insist that what he called a soft slap was completely fair when one had to keep one's partner in line. And he scoffed at the thought that the prosecutor clearly couldn't use her imagination to see what he was trying to get across. So, let's just be clear here. Any non-consensual physical touching of a person with your own body or an object can be considered assault. You can gently poke someone in the forehead or grab their arm, you can throw a cup of coffee at them. No matter how entitled you think you are to that action, you are not. It is assault. Assault is not just punching someone in the face or beating them over the head with a cricket bat. You have no rights to another individual's body. Full stop. But try as the prosecutor might, she could not get Donald to accept this. And really, that spoke volumes. Finally, Donald's testimony moved to the night of Dolly's murder. He claimed that while they were getting ready for bed, he'd started to tell Dolly about his son coming to visit and let her know that she wouldn't be able to stay there for a while. He claimed that because, in his opinion, Dolly was very drunk, she'd become enraged and told him that he probably just wanted to move the child's mother in too. Just a note here that the toxicology results did pick up alcohol in Dolly's system, but it was not at a high level. Of course, that does not dictate an individual's own reaction to the presence of any alcohol in their system, as some people can behave very differently, even after just one drink. But Dolly did drink regularly, and no one else had reported her being violent or aggressive while drinking. Donald claimed that when Dolly had become angry, he'd left the bedroom, gone into the lounge, and laid down on the couch. Dolly had allegedly followed him into the lounge, grabbed a knife off the kitchen counter, and started to come toward him as though she were going to stab him. Donald said he dodged a few swipes of the knife, and then Dolly had lowered her hand, and he grabbed her arm and squeezed her hand until she dropped the knife. He then put it back in the kitchen and lit a cigarette, thinking that the incident was now over. But Dolly had grabbed the knife again and continued to try to stab him. He claimed she kept jerking her hand toward herself while she held the knife, and at one point he'd heard her make a strange sound and then noticed blood appearing on the thigh of her pants. He claimed that at this point he was shocked and told Dolly that they needed to take her to the hospital. He'd given her a towel to hold against her wound, but she'd soon collapsed onto a rug in the lounge. After a little while, he claimed that he'd convinced her to move into the bedroom so he could change her pants and they could go to the hospital. She'd laid down on the bed, according to him, and he'd changed her pants and then started preparing the car for their trip to the hospital. In his preparations, he said he'd carried Dolly's bloody pants and dressing gown as well as the bloody towels into the car. He could not explain why he'd done this. He'd also spent time cleaning up some of the blood, as he said he didn't want it to stain, and then he'd changed his own clothes, which were by then covered in blood, and put the shirt and the rug in the washing machine and his pants in the dustbin outside. Again, he could not explain why he'd done any of these things in preparation for a trip to the hospital with Dolly. And it's probably important to note that the hospital was just 900 meters from Donald's flat. With all his inexplicable preparations made, he went back into the bedroom to get Dolly loaded into the car and found that he couldn't wake her up. He claimed that he then realized that she was dead. He said he'd tried to perform CPR on her, but it hadn't worked. He then said he'd sat on the couch for a long time and occasionally returned to Dolly's body to see if her condition had changed, before finally accepting that she was indeed dead. He also claimed that he himself had sustained injuries to his fingers from the knife, but after almost 10 days on the run, they'd completely healed before he was arrested. His injuries, he claimed, were sustained while he was trying to defend himself from Dolly. Donald's explanation, of course, did not match the physical evidence, and both in cross-examination and later through additional evidence from the pathologist after the state asked to reopen their case, the prosecution would point out each and every inconsistency. The most glaring and obvious oddity was the fact that Donald had done all of these unnecessary things before allegedly preparing to take Dolly to the hospital, despite seeing how much she was bleeding from her wound. Donald could only explain this by saying that he was in shock and not really aware of the seriousness of the situation until he found that Dolly had died. This, of course, did not ring true. His own pants were soaked in Dolly's blood, because he was standing face to face with her when she had been stabbed, and the knife wound had hit an artery. The vast amounts of blood on his own pants must have alerted him to the seriousness of the situation, and after all, he'd chosen to throw those pants away rather than place them in the washing machine. The depth of the stab wound also did not match up with the type of struggle-induced injury Donald was claiming. The pathologist said it would have taken an incredible amount of force to drive the knife as deeply into Dolly's groin and thigh as it had been, and it was highly improbable, if not impossible, that this would have happened by accident. It also did not appear to be the type of wound that could be self-inflicted. Perhaps the most damning of evidence came to light through the pathologist, who stated that Dolly was already dead when she was placed on the bed, and also when her pajama pants were changed. He knew this because of the lack of presence of blood in the bedroom area. The pathologist believed that Dolly had been stabbed in the lounge and she had collapsed onto the floor where she'd been left to lay for an extended period. During this time, she'd bled to death, and Donald had moved her body to the bedroom and redressed her. There was no sign of active bleeding from Dolly anywhere other than in the lounge and when she was wearing that first pair of pants. This meant that her heart had stopped beating and pumping blood by the time she was moved. This also explained why Donald had originally refused to say whether Dolly had been alive and talking to him in the bedroom. The prosecution believed that Donald may not have planned the murder of Dolly that specific night, but he had harbored intentions to harm her, and on that night, he had certainly purposefully plunged the knife into her groin area and done so with enough force to create a large gaping and life-ending wound. His own injuries, which could not have been so severe if they'd managed to heal completely in 10 days, could just as easily have been caused by his hand slipping from the handle of the knife and onto the blade as he plunged the knife into Dolly, and didn't necessarily have to show that he'd been defending himself at all. From my perspective, and although it doesn't seem that this was raised at all in the trial, I also have to wonder if it's really a coincidence that Dolly was so viciously stabbed in the very area of her body that Donald Sebolai seemed to have so many negative opinions about. Ultimately, the forensic pathologist had determined that although Dolly was losing blood quickly from her wound, considering the close proximity of the hospital, if Donald had applied pressure to the wound and immediately taken Dolly to get medical care, there was a possibility that she could have survived the injury. Donald insisted that any testimony that painted him in a bad light, including that of the investigating officer who testified that Donald had been enraged in the hours after his arrest and shouted about how much he hated women, were all lies. According to him, every single person who had taken the stand for the prosecution was either lying or tailoring their evidence to make him look bad. He said it was impossible that he could hate women because his mother was a woman, and he had a daughter. Of course, that's not really how it works. Any sex can absolutely harbour illogical hatred toward another, regardless of how many people in their lives belong to that sex. And with that final insistence that he was the true victim in the situation, Donald stood down from the stand. Next up was a psychiatrist hired by his defence, Professor Sathasivan Cooper, had conducted three sessions with Donald in the lead up to the trial, including some hypnosis, which, according to him, Donald hadn't been aware had been happening. The professor said that he used this technique with individuals to ensure that he was getting an unfiltered narrative, almost directly from their subconscious. While the veracity of such a technique is largely untested, the professor said he'd always had good results with it in the past. He said that the version Donald had given him was identical to that in his plea statement, and he'd found that after Dolly's death, Donald had been suffering from depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. And yes, it is not entirely uncommon for individuals who have committed a murder to suffer with these conditions. The human mind is complex, and even if an individual has fully premeditated a murder and really wants to commit it, the experience of actually doing it can still leave its mark on the brain and the nervous system. This is not in any way linked to remorse, of course. People can suffer a PTSD-like experience around a crime they've committed and still not be sorry they did it. The prosecution put it to Professor Cooper that he had not sought out any facts of the crime or physical evidence to compare against the version that Donald had given him in order to determine the truthfulness of it. Cooper agreed that he'd not done this and therefore could not be 100% sure that Donald hadn't lied to him. But he also didn't feel that this was his role. On the whole, Cooper believed that while Donald's reaction after Dolly's injury may not have been what most people would have done, nor surely what should have been done, it was a natural reaction for him. Donald had chosen to flee rather than seek assistance. And although it was perhaps not correct in that situation, Cooper believed that it had been a decision made in a state of shock. On the 12th of October 2015, Judge Kasim Musa began to pass down his judgment on Donald Sebolai. After analysing all the evidence presented, he had decided that there was insufficient proof that Donald's actions had been self-defence. Judge Musa said that Donald had seen how badly injured Dolly was, and yet he had chosen not to seek assistance for her. And instead, he'd allowed her to bleed to death on the floor of his apartment before moving her body to the bed, inexplicably changing her pajama pants, and then fleeing the scene, leaving her locked inside the flat. Donald Sebolai was found guilty of the murder of Rachel Dolly Tshabalala, as well as defeating the ends of justice. The judge did not find him guilty on the theft charge. The prosecution asked the judge to withdraw Sebolai's bail, as they feared he would flee the country before his sentencing hearing. The judge agreed, and Sebolai was taken back into custody. His sentencing proceedings would only begin in February 2016. At that time, Donald once again took the stand to reaffirm that he had not intended for Dolly to die and begged the court to show him mercy in sentencing. Directly addressing Dolly's mother, Elizabeth, Donald said, "Mama, you know we loved each other." Elizabeth stared back at Donald, without even acknowledging that he'd spoken. The prosecution told the judge that it was clear that Donald had shown a pattern of being abusive toward women, and that he'd even expressed himself how he thought there was nothing wrong with slapping women. Donald's mother took the stand to testify in mitigation for her son. She told the court that she'd been totally shocked when she'd heard what had happened because her son had never been in trouble with the police in his life. Donald sobbed as his mother spoke about what a wonderful man his son was and how much he did for their family and those less fortunate in the community. Despite his lawyer emphasizing that his client was deeply remorseful for the, quote, unfortunate occurrence, the judge questioned whether this could be true when Donald refused to admit that he was guilty of the murder of Dolly. Finally, in March 2016, Judge Musa handed down his sentence. Donald Sebalai was sentenced to 20 years imprisonment on the murder charge and 5 years for defeating the ends of justice. These would run concurrently. Judge Musa said that Donald had run away from the scene like a coward, and while he was surely regretful that it had occurred, he had shown no true remorse. Donald Sebalai would be required to serve at least half of his determinate sentence before becoming eligible for parole. It's therefore likely that by next year, 2026, he may become eligible for the first time. By the time Donald takes his next breath of air outside prison, Dolly's daughter will have matriculated from high school. She will have spent an entire childhood and all her teenage years without her mother. I can't help but see a far darker version of this crime than is presented at the surface level. And maybe that's just my worst-case scenario thinking from too many years of being immersed in true crime on a daily basis. But I think that, just like the perpetrator in this crime had a shiny and palatable facade he showed the world, when far darker things were brewing inside, the crime has been presented as an unfortunate series of events, and the poor choices of a man who should have done better in the moment but didn't. And that's not what I'm seeing. Call me crazy, but there's a lot of anger behind a stab wound that goes at least 9 centimeters into a person's groin area. And I can't help but think it was targeted anger. Donald Sebalai isn't your ordinary cold-blooded killer. He presents very differently. But there was a moment in some footage I was watching that really sent shivers down my spine. It was after the sentencing and before Donald was taken back down to the cells. He agreed to speak with a journalist, and he was sitting with his mother on one of the benches. But he wasn't just sitting with her. He was pretty much sitting on her lap. I know that sounds weird, and the camera didn't show the bottom half of their bodies, but that is really what it looked like. Donald was talking into the camera, but the whole time he was rubbing his cheek against his mother's neck, and his hand was on her chest, moving in circles on the exposed skin above her shirt. Maybe it's just me, but I thought it was very bizarre behavior. I'm certainly not shaming anyone, male or female, for showing affection toward their parents when they're older, but this just felt like it was crossing some sort of line. And pair that with Donald constantly referencing back to his mother whenever Dolly's genitals were mentioned, and I don't know. It's just odd. Yes, that's my entirely unprofessional assessment of it. Odd AF. All of this assumption aside, there's simply no way that Donald can truly believe he did the right thing. He was undoubtedly, purposefully, waiting for her to bleed to death. I have no doubt that when Dolly started to experience abuse from Donald, she must have thought to herself, "No one is going to believe me. Look at this man. He's loved by so many. He goes on air on a daily basis and speaks with authority on women's issues and stands up for women's rights. He has a crowd of fans who follow him and would never ever believe he could be the very thing he stands against." In the minutes before her death, Dolly glimpsed what so many had never seen. The real Donald Sebalai. The man who believed he had the right to use physical violence against his partners, who even as he was being tried for murder, went to great pains to be seen as a successful ladies' man, who would watch the woman he claimed to love bleed to death on the floor as he towered over her. And then, as the darkness overtook her, She may have felt him pulling her body towards the bedroom so that he could start his cover-up. Dolly should have finished her second degree just a few months after she lost her life. She was eager to show her daughter that a woman could be independent and educated and brave and strong. And I really do hope that that is exactly what her daughter took from her mother's life. That, and perhaps the knowledge that the public facade doesn't always match the private reality when the mask eventually falls away. Rachel Dolly Shabalala, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.